Good evening. My name's Joe. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Joe.
They always forget when they're introducing me that I get to go next. I'd like to thank the committee for inviting me. This is an honor and a privilege. Especially to be invited back to the same place where we moved. Those that know me know that that's a miracle in my life. Mm-hmm. I'm not talking drunk, even. I'm talking at my very best, on my best behavior, sober. 14 years, it's amazing sometimes when I get invited back to the same place every month. Yeah. It's also amazing that I have friends here that I've had for a long period of time. That's not the way it was 14 years ago. It's amazing that there would be somebody here that calls me his sponsor and he sponsors people and he's active in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and has a desire to get free. I have brought a lot of people in the age of prayer and inventory in a lot of different ways. Sometimes comfortable ways and sometimes uncomfortable ways. I was here 5 years ago at your first, I was going to say melon head roundup, but I told Rick I wouldn't say that. In the Quad City area. Five years ago we were in a really beautiful room. Actually, for those that weren't here, it was a tent down by the river. One thing sticks in my consciousness from that morning, from that weekend, and not only meeting Rick, but Rick made the mistake of, he was my host, and that certainly wasn't a mistake, but at a lunch that we had, I think on Saturday afternoon, Rick made the mistake of asking me, could he ask me a question? And I come from a group in Santa Monica, California, where we've been asking each other questions for about 10 years as part of our format, and I sit in my living room with alcoholics on a regular basis who ask a lot of questions, and he made the mistake of asking me, could he ask me a question, and I said, can I give you an answer? He said yes, and about 45 minutes later, he wasn't sure if he was in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and exactly what was going on, and asked me to be his sponsor. And I was told from the very beginning to look for the miracles in my life. And I have found over the years there's a great way to miss the miracles. Because I believe there are miracles, and I believe there are coincidences, and I believe there are accomplishments. And all an alcoholic like me has to do to miss the miracles is take the credit. And there's times when my ego tries to do that, and there are times when I absolutely realize something is happening here beyond my control or my choices or what I think is best. And I realize the miracles. Sometimes I realize just sitting quietly in a chair or on the floor, or sometimes I realize that just the next exhale is an amazing miracle, just the next breath. And sometimes I'm fortunate enough to be given an experience where I realize something that's even closer than that, even closer than my next breath, even closer than my next thought, closer than my next emotion, closer than anyone I've ever had in my life. And sometimes I'm given the awareness to realize I also have an ego that's strong enough to separate me from the closest thing to me and convince me it's probably the furthest thing away. And that's what I'm up against. And I'm just, my sobriety date is August 17th, 1982, and I have a serious problem, 14 years sober. And my serious problem is that I can't keep myself sober. And I haven't always been aware of that. And there are times where I'm taking the credit and I'm in a form of denial that a lot of people don't want to talk about. And I know that I'm no more different or special or better than any other alcoholic in this room. And I have some friends, thank God, who are willing to talk about this kind of denial. And it's when I'm taking the credit for a gift that's unearned and undeserved. And it's a very subtle form of denial, and it's stronger than the denial I came here with, the denial that we do talk about a lot. That, you know, the only disease that tells you you don't have one. The denial of the disease of alcoholism. And I got past most of that a long time ago and saw that I really do have this thing. It's different having an idea that you're alcoholic from stuff you learned in 10 treatment centers and having a full concession to your innermost self of what it means to say you're alcoholic and be one. I'm not sure if that's a very pleasant thing to find out. And I've met people in Alcoholics Anonymous, myself included, who have taken long periods of time saying that they're alcoholic and having not a clue what it means to admit that to their innermost self, because there are two experiences that are like night and day. And at 7 years, the first time I woke up to this kind of denial, and at 9 years when I saw it again, and 11 years when I saw it again, and 15 years when I saw it again, and in a quite subtle form, sometimes it's not so subtle. And it was shocking to me, a guy who thinks that he's pretty awake most of the time, to find out just how asleep that I can be. And that denial is, you've all heard it before. Somebody will get up and share a birthday. I don't know what they do here on birthdays, but in Southern California, you'll get up to take a cake, and somebody in the back of the room will say, and it's real subtle, someone will say, "How'd you do it?" And your ego will go, "Excuse me?" And they'll go, "How did you do it?" And you'll say, "Well, my name's Joe, and I'm an alcoholic, and that means I'm powerless over alcohol, and my life is unmanageable." And then you'll spend about 10 or 15 minutes telling them how you keep yourself sober and manage your life. And I'm in the absolute denial of the grace of God, taking the credit for a free, undeserved gift, and I missed the miracle. Because it's just one more accomplishment in a long line of accomplishments that Joe Hawk has pulled off. And it killed me. Because I didn't miss the most important thing in my life. Sometimes I think, well, something that happened last week was just a coincidence. When an alcoholic like me says it was a coincidence and God wants to remain anonymous, he doesn't mean God wants to remain anonymous. He means that he wants to take the credit. I don't believe God wants to remain anonymous. I believe my third step decision and my third step prayer on a daily basis is about bearing witness to what he has done with his power and his love and the way of life that I've been given. But I have an ego that wants to write it off as old, you know, my little buddy, H.P., who kind of puffs me out a little here and a little there, and forgetting. I think it's kind of funny, an alcoholic like me would sit around wondering whether he should turn his will and his life over to that which gave him both in the first place. And after the kind of life that I've had, to actually sit around with guys like this and debate, now let me see here. Am I really powerless over alcohol? Really? And let me think about this now. Is my life, you mean like it's really unmanageable? I have this 20 years of devastation and I'm going to sit around wondering, only an alcoholic like me to do something like that. I don't have a tie on tonight. 5 years ago, I wore one because Dick Martin scared me. And, out of respect, I wore one. Now it's 5 years later, and he's not here. One time I wore one, and this is the night I learned the difference between humiliation and humility. I wore one and I went in the bathroom to get really spiritual, and I got down on my knees and I said a prayer, and I woke up and my tie had been resting in the urinal. And, I learned the difference between humiliation and humility, and I think humility was when I got down, and humiliation was when I got up. I've never worn one since. It's a virgin therapy. I used to practice it on alcoholics in Denver at a place called Raleigh Hill, and they said, you really ought to go there, because they teach you to not drink by puking. And I said, no, that was just a big part of my drinking. I don't think that would be good. I'm also well aware you can't get from where I was 14 years ago to here on your own power. Matter of fact, I'm well aware you can't get from where I was 48 hours ago to here on your own power. So I have to tell you a little bit about where I was 48 hours ago and where I was 14 years ago. I used to think my drunk log wasn't very important. And it wasn't for me to find out why I'm alcoholic, because the drama of where my drinking took me does not join me to most of you. And isn't it interesting, and isn't it typical, that my ego was using the things that separate me from you to join me to you? Because my ego doesn't want me to join you. It doesn't want me to join to you. So it was using everything that I can use to keep me separate from you with a strong desire in my heart to be connected to you. That's all I ever really have wanted. All I've ever really have wanted is to be connected to myself, my true self, to God, and to you. That's all I've ever wanted, and that's all I still want. And I'm no longer interested in the things that separate me from you. But I did find out not too long ago it's important for me to share the miracle of my life and how I see that miracle of where I was and where I am, and the fact that I can't get myself from where I was to where I am. And it's important for me to share some of that with you. But it has nothing to do with why I'm alcoholic. I can tell you why I'm alcoholic. I'm alcoholic because when I start drinking alcohol, I can't control alcohol. And I get a physical craving for more alcohol. And every alcoholic that's in this room has that. And I also have a mind that takes me back to alcohol over and over and over and over. And I could talk to you for a week about how that is true for my drinking. And that's not so scary to look back at if there's something I can do about it now to keep myself from that first drink. But it's because of people like you, my friend Cindy, who I'm very glad to see. People like Ed and Rick and Joe and people here that I know that remind me on a regular basis to look back at my experience and realize I can't keep myself from the first drink. And once in a while, here and there, you find a friend that will also remind you that they can't eat. Once in a while, you'll find some people in this program that will try to convince you that they can keep you from the first drink. And that's why you should want what they have. Nobody can keep me from that first drink. And I'm glad to have had a sponsor all these years who's well aware of that. He keeps turning me back to something that's already working in me. Isn't it amazing an alcoholic like me, all he has to be brought to on a regular basis is the realization of something that's already there. And thank God that that something that's already there doesn't care whether I give it credit or realize that it's there to work. Because if I was dealing with a God that needed to be given the credit, I would have been drunk a long time ago, because I started taking the credit just past 30 days. See, 30 days I knew I could do. I had done 30 days several times, but I had never made it 31 days in 18 years of drinking alcohol. In 10 treatment centers in the Michigan State Penitentiary and several other jails, as a therapist in the treatment center, I drink. I drink. That's what I do. I drink. I heard a guy not too long ago where I got sober in Denver, Colorado. And he said that in a very calm and peaceful way, he said, 35 years sober, he does not care what anybody in the world thinks about what he does with the book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he said, you know why? Because they're not the ones that are going to drink. Over the work that I do or don't do, I'm the one that's going to. I also have come through a big chunk of stuff in the last couple of years where I absolutely do not know what anybody in Alcoholics Anonymous needs to do. And any of you that have told me knows that that's a big shift for me. Because for a long time, I actually thought I knew what people in Alcoholics Anonymous should do or not do. I don't even know what the people that ask me for help should do. Because I don't believe it's anything done that's given me what I have, so how can I show them what to do? I can only show my experience with the process that has taken me to the realization that it's nothing I've done that's given me what I have. I'm at a point in my life that just happens to be where I think I am or I can. That's just the way it is right now at this time, and it's been really beneficial. Of course, I'm very close to my sponsor and a couple of guys, and I heard one of these, oh, the interesting thing about that is that one of the most interesting things I've ever read in the stories in the back of the book, written by a woman, I think the title of her story is even kind of interesting. She called her story Promoting the Chronic. Like being called a chronic alcoholic was a promotion for her. And at the end of her story, she says one of the most top things I've ever heard in any of this offices. You might check that out in the last couple of paragraphs of her story. Another woman I heard not too long ago said that on a regular basis she's been taken to a place in Alcoholics Anonymous that's a very fortunate place. And that very fortunate place is when she realizes there's absolutely nothing she can do about this. And she's then turned to seeking a deeper relationship with that which already is doing something about it. And I get reminded. And I get brought back. And I get moved from me being the solution of what I'm going to do about this terrible problem that keeps me always focused on it, to realizing there's nothing I can do, and then I'm shifted to seeking that which can, and I go from being the solution to the one with a very serious problem. Because as long as there's anything I can do about it, I'm put in a very small time in that unfortunate place where they think there's something they can do about it without them, on their own. And I think that's what a lot of this has been. There's an ache, eliminating every obstacle that separated me from what I always was looking for. Because I looked for it in this, and it brought me to this. And I looked for it in this, and it brought me to this. And then I started spending a long period of time in Alcoholics Anonymous, eliminating every option that's between me and this thing that so desperately wants me to be close to it. And I would try this stuff, and I would try a little of this, and it would be her, and then it would be this, and it would be a little more money, and slowly options, all those alternatives, bring me back to that there's really an alcoholic death, which isn't pretty, and it usually isn't quick, or live on a spiritual basis, and those are not easy alternatives to face. We'll still have some other ones. The only time those options face for me when I pull off either one. I'm a failure at dying an alcoholic death. I failed at that. Those that are successful at dying alcoholic death aren't here tonight. Those of us that are here tonight are the ones that have failed at real successful. I was supposed to have myself little dad, and I was real successful dad. Beat myself. I'm not sober. I'm not. I know that about five people who would be worshiping me. And I've been. So often, the two alternatives. Yeah. See, there's. Some of you are aware of those. I think it's in the chapter to the wise. They describe four alcoholics. Type number one, type number two, type number three, type number four. Now, type number one, he's not that bad yet. He's got this left and this left and then this and a little of this. And type number two, this and he's showing up here. Type number three, he's starting to show up at places. Type number four is absolutely isn't it interesting that they say in our book that type number 4 has a better chance at this program than type number 1? Now, why is this? The logical mind, a person who doesn't suffer from lack of power, would probably say, thank God it doesn't make any sense to them, but they don't have any sense to us. You know who I mean by them, right? Those people that can have a drink and have. And 350 feet away from them in a restaurant, way down there, it's not the drink that bothers them. If that guy left way over there, it bothers me. I can't relate to him leaving. Yeah. Or like my mom, she says things like, I better stop now. I'm starting to thank God our spiritual principles don't make any sense. I don't understand. Yes, you're wrong. It's not that you won't love the same person. It's great to be in a relationship with an unhealthy Al-Anon. For a little while. For a little while. 2.5 years. Because at least you both love the same person. Sometimes you both love the same person. Just a little bit too much. I think part of this story should be told because she's not here and she can't tell it. But I was in love with a lady, God's Will number 3. named Nancy, who came to our group 9.5 years ago. And she was a little off and she wasn't real connected and she didn't have that feeling that you and I have, like, you know, I'm home. She didn't have that. And she had never sponsored anybody, by the grace of God. She was doing everything in AA but AA. She loved being around us. She loved the fellowship. She loved me. And I loved her. She sat down with a woman in our group that has what she wants for the wrong reason. They started going through the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and about 4 weeks later, she comes back to this woman's house, and she says, I need to tell you something. That doesn't happen. Let me tell you what it's like to be your mom. Daddy, every boyfriend I've ever had. She started talking to this lady about a physical craving and a mental obsession for the alcoholic rooted in a spiritual malady, a physical craving that increases from our energy. I can't comprehend somebody wanting to be around me. I can't comprehend that. And she goes through the steps, and she finds her program. She has a strong Al-Anon sponsor, Vinod. And she feels... Especially because Brian has only been in our group since day 6. And Brian doesn't know anybody. He just doesn't know anybody. He doesn't have any old ideas about who he thinks he is in AA. He doesn't care about speaking. He has no reputation to defend. And Brian will just ask anybody anything. He doesn't care. But he really cares. He really cares. He's got nothing to lose. He has absolutely nothing to lose. But just a really big ego. So he says, let me ask you a question. He says, I don't understand this physical craving for an alcoholic. She says, you don't need to. It's not your problem. I don't understand yours either. She says, I don't need to understand your physical craving. It's not my problem. He says, well, then let me ask you. Why do so many of you end up in Alcoholics Anonymous? And she looks at him with this look like, you big dummy. And she says, what would you do to stay in a bar with a free tab? And I got it. I don't understand it, but I got it. She said, you'd even do the work with me in the big books and have them legal and hang out with the guys that are your drugs. She got to get free of it. She got to get help from the program that she belongs to. She doesn't need that anymore from Alcoholics. She found it from something much stronger. A really tough Al-Anon sponsor. No, not really. That's like the joke about the Al-Anon golfer. The moral of the story is you got to be careful for what you pray for. But you also have to be careful for what they pray for. This is probably dangerous because bogus is going next tomorrow. So I'll be careful with this. Al-Anon golfer out on the course drives a ball in the woods. She goes to look for it. Out from behind a tree pops a leprechaun. I can't do the voice, but he comes out from behind the tree and he says, today's your lucky day. You get three wishes. She says, great. He says, but there's one little catch. He says, what's that? He says, well, your husband's going to get 10 times whatever you wish. She gets that little Al-Anon gleam in her eyes and she says, no problem. He says, what's your first wish? She says, every shot I ever make on every golf course be great. He says, granted, but your husband's going to be 10 times better. She says, no problem. He says, what's the next wish? She says, $1 million cash. He says, granted, but you know your husband's going to get 10 million. She says, no problem. He says, what's your next wish? She says, well, I'd like him to have just a little teeny heart attack. Well, I'd like to have just a little teeny heart attack. I almost died. I've been listening to a guy lately who's been talking to me about the train of hope that works for an alcoholic. It has to do with that story about the 4 different types of alcoholics and how type number 4, who's out of hope, has more of a chance in AA than the guy who has some options and some hope left, that other kind of hope. And he's been talking to me about 2 kinds of hope. He's been talking to me about that kind of hope that works for those people out there that you and I don't understand, that don't have lack of power, those people that have power. There are people with power. They don't sell 300 million self-help books a year because self-help doesn't work. It just doesn't work for us. You know those people that can hear an inspirational message or read an idea in a self-help book and go home and say, honey, I realize that this is why I do this, and if I just start doing this, I'll be able to be like this. And all they have to do is hear an inspirational message grounded in something they can do about problem X, Y, or Z, and they just, with that great awareness that they've never heard before, they just start doing X, Y, and Z about A, B, and C. And that kind of an inspirational message looks for him. He said, why do you think that kind of an inspirational message, you know, the messages that are grounded in something you can do on your own? Like, just don't break the mind. Just stop being something. Nothing like making amends to someone in AA that doesn't know what it means to be alcoholic. And you make amends and they say, when you ask them what you could do in the future, they say, don't ever lie again. Yeah, right. Never lie again, ever. And you just broke the amends. You just lied again. And he said, we did a great inspirational message. You know one of those things you hear, some guy gets you all pumped up about what you're going to do about this problem. And you go home and you're all pumped up with this false hope. That false hope that works for those people out there. And then 5 to 6 weeks later, you find yourself back in stark, raving fear. And he says it always goes from hope to fear. From hope to fear. Because the message. So I said, then what's the hope that works for an alcoholic? He said, then there's no hope. You mean hope comes from no hope? He
as long as there's any hope of anything I can do, why would I turn to something else more powerful than me if I have the power to take care of any problem? Why would I turn to something more powerful than me? Why would I turn to a solution if I am a solution? It would just be a nice, virtuous thing to maybe do to some regional sponsor. I really need God. I really need God. But let me tell you what I'm going to go do. That's like the story my sponsor told me about sponsorship. Best story I've ever heard on sponsorship. A guy and his sponsor are walking down the road. In our group, we don't use the word digital or baby. New people like me, when I came in, just don't need to be demeaned just anymore. Don never referred to me as either of those things. He referred to me as a friend. When he would introduce me, this is my friend, Joe. That was amazing to me because I had lost my last friend. In May 1982. Last one I had left in the world. Knew me since I was 7 years old. Left me on a street corner in Denver, Colorado and said, I don't ever want to see you again. Ruined my life. I was engaged to a girl that I wanted to spend the rest of my life with. I told you you could come here from Key West, Florida, and you just couldn't drink. Because of you, I've lost her, and I don't ever want to see you. And the first time Don ever called me a friend, I was lonely. I was 3 years sober. We were driving from Denver to the International in Montreal in 1985 in a Winnebago. With him and his wife and his kids and me and my fiance, God's will number one. And about 350 miles down the road, Don asked me to drive. For some of you, that wouldn't be a big deal. And it didn't seem like a big deal to me. I just got behind the wheel and I started driving. About 50 miles later, I realized this man truly. And you know, it's relative to where you come from. And if people were trusting you with their families when you were drinking and giving you... The other day, in Sydney, Australia, that's what I meant. You can't get from where I was 2 days ago. I was invited to go to Sydney, Australia, 2 weeks, to speak at Alcoholics Anonymous. And my question, getting on the plane from, not from L.A. to St. Louis, but that one from St. Louis to Moline, my question was, you can't get from where I was 2 days ago to where I am on your own power. The next question was, if you had any power, why would you want to anyway? And then I was reminded why. Because I told those people in Sydney, Australia on Tuesday morning when they were putting me on the plane that if it wasn't Rick Carter and some really good friends, I'd be calling and telling them my friend Cindy's going to fill in on Friday night because I'm staying in Australia for another month. But I couldn't do that. Because I live a certain way today with power in my life. And that has to do with saying what you're going to do and then doing what you say you're going to do. The best definition of honesty I've ever heard for an alcoholic like me. Because I used to say what I was going to do or not say what I was going to do, and then I'd do something totally different because I suffer from lack of power. I didn't want to break my mother's heart over and over and over. I didn't want to drink and show up drunk at the day of my dad's funeral. And I said to my mother, the person I love more than anybody in the world, I won't show up drunk at my father's funeral. And I did. And I continued to break her heart. And we forget sometimes it's relative to where you come from. There's a guy in our group, if he got up tonight to read How It Works, 90% of you would think, what's the big deal? Jaime's reading How It Works. Some of you who would know where he came from would know that for Jaime, that is a really big deal. Honey can't read or write. It's an interesting little story. Honey was born on the Exodus, a boat that went from Poland to Israel. They wouldn't let him in. Honey was going to die because his mother couldn't feed him, and they were going to flush him down the toilet. And a lady saved him and kept him alive until they got him into Israel. And at 9 years old, he was brought to New York and just let him go on the streets of New York. And Jaime went from a millionaire three times over
He owned restaurants and grocery stores and this and that, big-time drug dealer. I knew of Jaime before I ever knew Jaime from a bust in Louisiana that I had heard about. I didn't know it was him until later when I met him. Became his sponsor. Jaime went from all that, never being able to read or write, to under the bridge at Brighton Beach, unable to make a home for 3 years, with a kid and a wife down the street. He just couldn't get home for 4 or 5 blocks. And alcoholics know what that's about. That's not about not wanting to get home. That's about lack of power. And Jaime would say it was harder to not make it home sober in those intervals than it was when he was drunk. Because when he was drunk, he'd really want to, and he would almost make it. Because almost enough power was there from the booze to get there. But when he didn't have a drink, he couldn't even move. He couldn't even get close to getting home. He made it home 3 years later. His wife said, "Now it's my turn." She sat down in a beanbag chair and drank for several years. They get sober, they move to Los Angeles. They hear the message of Alcoholics Anonymous, they start doing the work in the Big Book, and they have a little Indian woman sewing bags in their kitchen for a year or so with Shelley, the wife, down in the garment district where they rent a wall to sell these bags. Now 4 years later, as a result of Alcoholics Anonymous and the power of God and the result of the work in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, Tiny's in his fourth factory. Shelley hasn't been down in that corner for several years. He's making tons of money. Huge payroll, employees, cars, fax machines. And Jaime still can't read or write. I heard a story about it's relative to where you come from, about a guy standing down at the coffee pot, and two women are watching him from over here. And one woman knows him from the streets in New York, and one woman knows him from Alcoholics Anonymous. And the woman that knows him from the streets in New York knows that 25 years ago, a man walked up to this kid, not Jaime, but a guy walked up to this kid that they're looking at and said blah, blah, blah about his father, and this kid just killed him. Just killed him. Now, 25 years later, he's been in prison. He's come to Alcoholics Anonymous. He's 5 years sober, and these two women are watching him. One knows him from when he was drinking. One knows him from AA. And they watch a man walk up to him at the coffee pot and say blah, blah, blah about his father. And this kid raises his voice a little bit and gives the guy a little push. And the lady that knows him from Alcoholics Anonymous says to the other lady, "How could that kid treat somebody like that? He raised his voice and he pushed the man. How could somebody do that in AA?" The other lady that knows him from when he was drinking goes, "He's come a long way." And sometimes I forget that from my own story, let alone yours. And where I come from is finding alcohol at an early age, and it did something for me I couldn't do for myself. In a real practical manner, I can explain what that first time I drank did for me. Because there was a girl at that dance that I wanted to dance with, and I couldn't muster up what it took to ask her, let alone dance with her. And these guys said, "Let's go outside for a minute. There's some stuff that you can drink. Make you feel better. You'll be able to go in that dance, and you'll be able to ask that little girl." And I thought, yeah, sure. Just like when I heard you people say that God can work. And I went outside with those guys and I took a few drinks and I walked back in that gym and I had some power. I had something doing for me what I couldn't do for myself. I walked up to that little girl and asked her to dance and it worked. We danced. And I chased that stuff around for a long time. By the time I was 19 years old, I was in the Michigan State Penitentiary from a family where that shouldn't have happened. My grandfather was vice president of Post Cereal, invented Post Toasties, lived in Battle Creek, Michigan. I was given everything I ever wanted. And I came here and I didn't have some of the excuses that some of you have. I heard people say they were alcoholic because mommy and daddy were. I heard some of you say you're alcoholic because you were deprived or depraved, or because you were a different color or came from a bad neighborhood. And this little story started to form in my mind. We hear a lot about the yets, but we don't hear much about the if-onlys. And I can't be the only one that had a little if-only story going on. And my story went like this. Well, if only Daddy wouldn't have been 57 when I was born. And if only, see, if you're alcoholic because your parents were, and my parents weren't, my little if-only story was, maybe if one of them would have been alcoholic, I wouldn't have learned my lesson and I wouldn't have turned out the way I did. maybe if I hadn't been given everything I ever wanted, I wouldn't have turned out the way I did. Maybe if I would have had to work a little bit hard. Maybe if I hadn't gone to school with those guys. Because my ego loves to keep the problem out here. My ego also loves to keep the solution out here, too. So I don't have to take any responsibility. And I'm sitting in the media in my first 90 days, and I heard a guy tell my little phone story. And he turned out just as sick as I did. And the lie got smashed. Because his drama was the opposite of my drama, and I found out the drama isn't what joins me to you. What joins me to you is that at an early age, I had a spiritual emptiness, whatever you want to call it. See, I don't have a twofold disease, body and mind. Those are just my symptoms. I have a much deeper part of my disease that nobody in 10 treatment centers ever talked to me about. And I couldn't hear until I saw it within myself for 6 months in the meetings. I'm sure you were talking about it. I'm sure I read the book. I'm sure I saw where it says you're not only bodily and mentally ill, but spiritually sick. And I knew why I was bodily and mentally ill. I used to give lectures on THIQ and neurotransmitters and chemical enzyme reactions, stuff that I don't even want to remember anymore. Those big, long words, so it keeps it up here and it never gets close to anything down here that makes you uncomfortable. Because they tell you, if it feels bad, it's bad. And if it feels good, it's good. And I bring that philosophy into Alcoholics Anonymous, and I stay away from anything that makes me uncomfortable. And as long as I do, I won't drink, because what feels bad is bad, and what feels good is good, until somebody says to me, didn't you do some stuff for about 18 years that felt really good that damn near killed you? And haven't you done some stuff in Alcoholics Anonymous that doesn't always feel good and has saved your life? And there's even a place beyond there that I've been taking once in a while where I lose my judgment about my own emotions, whether they're good or bad, because I don't know the difference. Our seven-step prayer even mentions, I come out of a fifth step thinking that stuff I thought I was doing that was really great was damn near killing me. And some stuff I thought was really bad saved my life. And the prayer says, all of them. Good. And there are times where I'm taking a place where my own emotions are bad or just hard. And I don't go from a place like that. I used to think I drank because I felt bad, but someone would say, what about when you felt really good? I used to think I drank because circumstances were bad, but what about repentance? I used to think I drank because of low self-esteem, but what about when you were feeling really great? All of a sudden, I started to see alcohol doesn't care how I'm feeling or how I'm doing, circumstantially or emotionally, as to whether I drink. We have all, some of you that have been around a lot longer than I have seen people that's feeling really great, doing really good. People feeling really bad, not doing well at all. People not feeling much at all, die. So just not feeling much at all. They got a teeth, so they just don't feel much at all. Because they think they can manage their life and be empowered and so. And that's what that's about. So they don't want to feel. So there's bad emotions and there's good feelings. So I realize these ones that I think are so bad are what bring me to my knees over and over and over back to God. And the ones that are really good sometimes distract me from that which I want to be close to, so I say. I had 6 years of kid stuff. Fun. Alcohol, work. I had a blast. From about 12 to 18. Woodstock. Private school. Boston. New York. Manhattan. All over. I was thrown out of the Americana Hotel in Manhattan before I could even drink legally. Fun stuff. Then I had 6 years of trouble. Michigan State Penitentiary, 7 more treatment centers. Some of you go on vacation once a year with a great American Express card or a Visa card. Well, I go to treatment on a regular basis because I have a great Blue Cross Blue Shield card. That's what I do. And when treatment hasn't answered that question as far as being a patient, you all know that question. You know that question, and I don't even have to say that question. Going to treatment didn't answer that question. So when going to treatment as a patient doesn't answer that question, what's the next logical thing for an alcoholic to do? Get a degree in psychology and work in a treatment center as a therapist. For the same reason you were there as a patient. And only other alcoholics would understand that. I'm either a patient in one or I'm a therapist in one, drinking with the director of the program that I was working for. To find out the answer to a question that had been there before I ever took a drink. And that question is, what's wrong with me? What's wrong with me? And I started asking that question about 2 years before I ever took a drink, sitting in my parents' backyard, dreaming that a spaceship was going to land and a little green man was going to get out, and he was going to say, you weren't born here on this planet. We brought you here as a teeny baby, and this has just been a test. And he was going to say, and you failed. You don't fit. We made a big mistake bringing you here. And that spaceship didn't land. So I took that drink in that gym, outside that gym, a couple of years later. My ship arrived. I fit. 19 years old, they closed the door on the Michigan State Penitentiary and they locked me up for a couple of years. I loved it. People say they don't like the penitentiary. I didn't like some of the stuff. But I was taken care of for 2 years and drank every single day I was locked up. Somebody tells you they can't get alcohol in the penitentiary, they're probably not alcoholic. You can drink in the penitentiary. Anybody tells you they went to treatment so they wouldn't drink, probably not alcoholic. I can drink in treatment with the director of the program that I'm working for. I can drink. You seen that Welch's commercial lately with that cute little kid? And he says, when you gotta have a drink, you just gotta have a drink, right? I'm the guy in the penitentiary when the spud juice would blow up once. They'd say, don't drink that stuff because that makes you blind. I'd say, that's one of my goals. They didn't understand, right? I was the guy they thought was crazy because I drank that stuff the first time it blew up before the second time it blew up. Good stuff, too. You don't get bad drugs or bad alcohol in the penitentiary. You wouldn't dare sell bad drugs in the penitentiary. And believe it or not, the best place to get drugs in the penitentiary is from the people that are keeping you there in the penitentiary. At least the one I was in. That's a whole other story. They let me out when I'm 21 years old, and I make a firm resolution not to drink, having drank every single day I was locked up. I got a plan. I got an aftercare plan. And every time I've ever had an aftercare plan, it failed because it was my plan of what I was going to do to not drink. In 28 days, I didn't drink, and they gave me some good reasons. They're called conditions of parole. Can't drink. Can't take drugs, can't hang out with ex-felons, can't go to bars, and can't leave the town. I mean, what's left? What's left? That's what I do. I drink, I take drugs, I hang out with ex-felons, and I go to bars, and then I leave the town. That's just what I do. They were telling me, don't breathe. Just don't breathe, no matter what. Right? Or we'll send you back to the Michigan State Penitentiary to a worse part of it. And for 28 days, that reason worked. Until it didn't. I walked out of his office on the 28th day, having made my second report, into a bar, picked up a drink, called the next felon, drove out of the county, and woke up 3 days later in a drug house 150 miles away in Detroit. And I didn't want to do that. And I didn't choose to do that, and it wasn't needed, it wasn't necessary, and it wasn't right. Because those things don't have anything to do with me drinking again, especially the idea that I had any kind of choice. And as insane as it was for me to think I had a choice that day, it is as insane to think that I have that kind of a choice today. It was in the sunlight of the Spirit, in a fit spiritual condition, on a daily basis, I have about as much choice to drink as I did not to drink. And God loves me that much. A lot of people say, God has given me the power of choice. I got one question for them. What kind of God did you choose that will give you a choice over something that you know is going to kill you? And it just doesn't fit with my conception. nor the 10-step promises. And if you're new, and they're telling you there's only 12 promises, they're lying. Because when I was new, and I heard 12 promises halfway through the 9th step, I'm sitting in the back of the room, and I'm saying to myself, you mean none of those great things are going to happen for me till I get halfway through a step that I'm never going to do? And thank God for a sponsor that said, there are promises from the title page through every single step in the big book. One of my favorite ones to this day that has happened every time I've ever done a 5th step is when you've returned home after a 5th step that you haven't withheld anything in. And that is, you will be able to sit alone at perfect peace and ease. And to one degree or another, that has happened every single time I've ever submitted myself to this process. I am not from the school that says you work 9 of our principles once and just practice 3 of them the rest of your life. I do believe the steps, the way they're written, are spiritual principles, and within those you get power to practice other principles when they shorten them down, like love and tolerance and patience. But I believe, for a guy like me, to admit that I'm powerless over and that my life is unmanageable, is in and of itself a spiritual principle. When I practice them on a regular basis, because the people in AA that have what I want, that's what they do. So I am as involved in fellowship as I am in recovery, as I am in service, and as a matter of fact, because of the promise of that circle and the triangle, I've been taken to a place where I don't see the separation between those three parts of the program anymore. But when I met Don P, 5.5 months sober, dying of a part of the disease I didn't even know I had, in a program that I wasn't even in, he talked to me about the circle and triangle and helped me see I wasn't in AA because I was going to meetings. I was a member of the fellowship because for the first time in almost 20 years, I didn't want to die and I had a desire to stop drinking, but that meant I don't want to continue feeling the way I'm feeling. When you all said to drink was to die, did not scare me when I was new. When you all said you might never have to drink again the rest of your life, that was not an attractive thing when I was new because I thought that meant feeling the way I was feeling the rest of my life. Are you kidding me? But when Don said, you might go on feeling the way you're feeling for a long time, that scared me. Because dying an alcoholic death might have been my only relief. And he talked to me about unity, recovery, and service. I wasn't in recovery, and I wasn't in service. And I got a little mad, and I said, well, I'm taking patients to meetings from where I used to go to treatment. Of course, he had one of those sponsor answers, and he said, oh, you're carrying people to the message. There's a big difference. And that didn't feel good. And he didn't respect my sensitive alcoholic feelings. Thank God. Because when you start to care about alcoholics like he does, you get taken to a place where you absolutely realize in your heart there are things that you must care about and there are things you can't care about. The things you must care about, that I must care about, is whether you live or die. The thing that I can't care about is how you might feel about anything that I have to say. Because you could sit in a room with 2 alcoholics and start to be consumed with how they might feel about something you have to say and go crazy in 10 minutes. Because both of them are going to feel every emotion there is in 10 minutes. They're going to feel the opposite of everyone. And if you start being consumed with how an alcoholic you're working with is feeling about what you might have to say, you will go absolutely. That's like I was sitting at home one night, and I started thinking about all the places that I wasn't speaking. Just in Los Angeles. Then I started to think about all the places that I wasn't being asked to speak around the country. And I looked in the grapevine. There was all these conferences every month going on, and I wasn't being asked to speak. Then I started to think about all the people that weren't asking me to help. And then I realized all these people that weren't calling me. And then I realized what a great distraction to keep you from where you are being asked to be. Where you are being asked to speak. Who you are being asked to help. And I'll go crazy. I'm the guy who crossed the room, but I was like 10, 11 years sober. Across the room in a crowded, smoke-filled room of Alcoholics Anonymous. God's Will number 3 walks into the room.
eyes meet from across the room, and that magical connection happens. And she sits down, and I sit down, and she starts to enjoy the meeting. She might remember that little connection we had, and wonder at the end of the meeting, well, I won't say a word to her. And I won't say a word to her because I'm really pissed. Now, why am I really pissed? Well, during the meeting, while she was there peaceful enjoying the meeting, I was naming our children. Planning the wedding, the honeymoon, why she was going to dump me, how painful that was going to be, and when the meeting was over, I wasn't going to say a word to her. That's the kind of mind I had. And at 7 years sober, sitting in my home group, I had the nerve to say something like, well, I had the nerve to actually believe when God's rule number two left me. I had the nerve to actually believe for a couple of days that she left me. And in Los Angeles, there's every meeting of every description of any kind to do anything that you would possibly want. And I go to one of those meetings where I could get away with, for a couple of days, she left me. And everybody would pat me on the back and go, we feel so sorry for you. You want to talk about, you know. And I made the mistake of not looking in the room while I was sharing about she left me, and my smart-ass friend Brian was in the back of the room hiding. And he heard me say that she left me. And I think that's the truth. If you would have asked me that day, why are you hurting? Why are you in pain? Why are you having trouble? I would have told you the absolute truth. I wouldn't lie to you. I would say, I am in pain because she left me. And Brian comes over in his nonchalant way. He says, well, why don't you go home and write inventory about her leaving you? And I believe that alcohol is cunning, baffling, powerful, that God is better be more cunning and more powerful and more baffling, or I would be wrong. And the process in this big book, the inventory process by itself is extremely powerful. It can take what I think is the truth and turn it into an absolute lie. Because I went home and I was tricked into putting down who and why I was with her in those first two columns of the piece of inventory. And I put her name and I put left. And that's the truth. That is the truth. That's the truth. Isn't it? Isn't it? And when she left me, it affected my self-esteem and my pride and my ambition and my security and my personal relations. And then my friend says, well, when she left you, why did it hurt your self-esteem? And the biggest lie that I can fall into is that when I'm angry, when she left me, it hurt my self-esteem because I'm a rotten piece of you-know-what and I don't deserve her in the first place. And he goes, wrong. You wouldn't have gotten mad if you truly believed that. You would have sat there like a lump as she left going, don't deserve you anyway, honey, because I'm a rotten piece of you-know-what. That's not what I did when she left me. He says, why did it affect your self-esteem? Well, because I think that I'm really wrong. Well, why did it affect your self-esteem when she left? And I get a little tension. I go, because I'm the greatest boyfriend in the world, and nobody should leave me. Bingo. That other voice, we all know about low self-esteem. It has absolutely nothing to do with romanticism. What it has to do with when I'm resentful is this other lower voice that's part of the community. Nobody should leave me. And I get to see these beliefs. And then I'm tricked into looking at my selfishness and how I did it with her. And my self-seeking and how I did it with her. And my dishonesty and how I did it with her. And my fears drove her away. She didn't leave. The first two columns get turned into a lie. That I had anything to do with the terms of the truth. And I admit this to another man who understands that truth and that type of selfishness. And I sit with a man who doesn't tell me that sort of thing. So that would be fun. One more guy telling me that that stuff is okay. Kill me. He helps me see where it's directly connected to me drinking alcohol again. And I get a deeper first step in the system. It is my reason for making this first step decision, and it's the reason I need to come earlier. And then I sit in my home group after admitting this stuff to somebody, and I say in my home group, or in a group that they're allowed to ask questions, I have the nerve to say, I'm praying for the women to make amends. I don't think anything. So somebody raises their hand, this little ex-Crypt guy that I used to sponsor. He raises his hand, he says, I'd like to ask Joe a question. Is it possible that you're not known and you'll know the moment you are? And I wanted to strangle that little guy. And I wanted to say, after all I gave you, you talk to me that way. And in my pious way, I said, maybe it is possible that I'm not going, and how will I know the moment I am? He said, the moment that you're willing to make that amends, you'll hear a really strange noise. And I thought, what? I never heard anything like that in my life. He said, the moment you're willing to make that amends, you'll hear a really strange noise. And I said, like what? And he said, like this. Bubble people. And you know what? The moment I was willing to make that amends, I heard a really strange noise. Me knocking on her door. A couple minutes later, I heard another really strange noise coming out of my mouth. I said, I need to talk to you about the harm I caused you. About 2.5 hours later, I heard another really strange noise come out of my mouth. I said, is there anything I could do to make it better? And then I heard another really strange noise coming out of my mouth, and it was the sound of silence. Very strange state of being. Out of my mind. And she said what I could do. The most amazing thing happened after, when I finally take her to that place, I had the power to do what she asked me. And 10 years ago this month, I had a really strange feeling that I was being moved from Denver. And in the middle of a set of amends, I asked a girl what I could do to make it right. She said, be here in Los Angeles 2 or 3 times a month so we can go to therapy and work this out, or at least end it for the first time in our lives in a healthy way. And if anybody knows how I feel about therapy now, having been in it for the last 3 years with a spiritual advisor, let alone how I felt about it then, let alone how I felt about being there for anything like that, would know that I am not the kind of guy that would follow through on amends like that. And that night at dinner with somebody that didn't even know why I was there in L.A., she goes, I don't know why I'm telling you this, but, and those of you that have been around a lot longer than I have, know on this path, when somebody says, I don't know why I'm telling you this, but, you listen. She said, I want you to go look in this apartment in Santa Monica. I said, I have no reason to get an apartment in Santa Monica. I'm happy and comfortable in Denver. Sponsors down the street, I got people to work with, I'm H&I chairman for the state, I'm the area committee, blah, 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 I got a great income, blah, 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 I'm having a great time, I love Denver, and I was put into an apartment on the beach in Santa Monica, and found out a little while later, in the last 10 years, what that was really about. It wasn't about me, it wasn't about settling for comfort, and it wasn't about doing what I wanted to do, because I wanted to stay in Denver down the street from my sponsor. And God had some other ideas, and because of a decision I've made on a regular basis and followed through with the action on that decision, my life is no longer any of my business. And I don't have to figure it out anymore. I just have to be awake to where I'm taking. And that's happening again. And it's scary when you're in a comfortable place with a great life. And it's happening again. And the same feelings are happening again since we're all made. It's a little scary, it's a little exciting, and I'm being taken to a place that I could never have imagined. I can't tell you about it right now because I haven't told my sponsor yet. I don't want some idiot calling him and him hearing it from them before he hears it from me, but I'm going somewhere that's really exciting, and I have to follow because my life is no longer any of my business, and I'm sure I'm going to be taken to a place and brought back to you and be with you. And be with you there, and be with you here, and be right here now, and be here this weekend. To grow in understanding and effectiveness, and that's what my life is about. So I love what we do. Thanks so much for coming.